And it was The Cure, Just Like Heaven. You're listening to KOWS LP Occidental. Welcome, everybody. This is Ann Hill. I am your host for the next hour on Dream Talk Radio. And today I have a really interesting guest on the phone. We'll be doing a live interview with Dr. David Van Nuys, who is, many of you may know him as the DJ for Shrink Wrap Radio, which is a very popular podcast on all sorts of topics in psychology at shrinkwrapradio.com. David Van Nuys is also an emeritus professor of psychology at Sonoma State. He has been the department chair there. He was the department chair for about 7 years. He's taught at a number of universities across the country, and he has worked as a psychotherapist and done all sorts of fascinating things. Dave Van Nuys, welcome to Dream Talk Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Ann.
Well, now the tables are reversed because you interviewed me for your podcast just a few weeks ago.
That's right, and I'm probably much more comfortable in the role of interviewer than interviewee.
Well, you know, it's kind of, I really enjoyed being interviewed by you, so hopefully we can have the same sort of repartee and fascinating conversation.
Yes.
Well, cows.
Yeah, I certainly did enjoy the interview that I had with you, and I got very positive commentary from my listeners about that interview.
Oh, very good.
One person stands out as saying, I've interviewed a lot of dream workers, and one person said that you were the best one.
Oh, well, that's very nice. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Glad to hear that.
Yes.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
that's how I get through life.
Exactly.
Both ways, giving and receiving.
it's a good practice. It's sort of like practice random kindness and,
exactly.
And flatter people when there's just cause.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to ask you, before we talk about the class that you teach at Sonoma State, which may interest a lot of people listening today, I want to ask you how you got into the podcasting thing. What was your trajectory from licensed psychotherapist to university professor to podcast king?
Yes, well, I wish my memory were better than it is, because I actually have trouble remembering exactly when I first heard the word podcast. It sort of threw me for a loop. It was about 5 years ago. It was August. I noticed that my first Shrink Wrap Radio episode is dated in August of 2005. And it would have been sooner, but it took me several months to figure out the technology and to get a website up that was doing what I wanted it to do. And finally, a friend said, David, don't be so perfectionistic. Just do it. Get it going. So that sort of gave me the kick in the seat that I needed to get it up by August, or otherwise I might still be trying to perfect it. So I heard the word podcast at some point, and it sort of threw me for a loop, because I think I already had an iPod and had been listening to audiobooks on my iPod and music. And as a former amateur radio operator, ham radio operator, the word cast suggests to me transmitting, broadcasting.
Yes.
And I knew there was no way that the iPod could transmit, or could it? So I went online right away to figure out what it was. And I saw that, in fact, it was audio shows, kind of like radio shows, that could be put up on the internet and that people could download onto their iPods. And I know the first podcast that I discovered was probably Adam Curry's The Daily Source Code, which was the entree for many people into podcasting. I don't remember him from this, but some of the people out there might. Adam Curry was, first of all, he is a descendant of the Curry family of Yosemite.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, and he was a video DJ or video jock for MTV back in the day, and the day being, I guess, sometime in the 70s. My kids probably knew who he was at that time, but I didn't. But at any rate, he's often referred to as the Podfather. And he was kind of the first official podcaster out there, and he helped to develop this RSS feed protocol on which podcasting relies. So once I discovered that's what podcasting was, and I had heard some podcasts, I immediately somehow, and this was right around the time that I was retiring. And you know how when you retire, if there are any people out there who have retired or who are close to retiring, it's a leap into the void. I didn't know necessarily what I was going to do after I retired, other than continue the market research business, which I also do. And podcasting kind of came swimming up at me out of the void and really has become a total preoccupation. And so when I asked myself, well, what could I do? What came to mind was, well, I've been a psychologist all these years at Sonoma State in the Bay Area, which is a hotbed of, you know, of humanistic psychology, transpersonal, existential psychology. Right. And I have lots of contacts that I've developed over the years, and I'm kind of a professional interviewer as a psychologist and also as a market researcher. And so interviews seemed like the way to go. And so initially I thought, well, I'll interview these people that I know, but it quickly expanded out to people that I didn't know. And that's been very gratifying, to make contact with authors and really people who are very significant in the field, and to find that the power of the microphone is such that they're willing to talk to me. Even though if they met me at a conference, they wouldn't give me the time of day, probably. So that's a rather long answer to your first question. It looks like we'll have no difficulty filling up an hour.
Well, I found that to be true, too. I think that in some ways, podcasters, and really radio, too, is a great leveler. You know, I have been able to talk with people on this show and have stuff lined up in the future, which, you know, if I were just a blogger, like a blogger in my pajamas, as Robert Moss and I were talking about last week on the show, people would really sort of, you know, delete the email. But if I have a radio show or a podcast, they're interested, because it is such, you know, as digital as we get, I think the audio format is something that just stays with people. We listen and we learn much more so than reading. You know, I think people get things by just hearing conversation that you can't actually, it's a little bit harder to grasp and to integrate when you have to read it and study it in some way.
Well, you know, many people who are listening to podcasts are listening on an iPod or some other kind of MP3 player. And I should hasten to let people know that if you haven't started listening to podcasts yet, I would certainly invite you to do so. And you don't have to have an iPod there. You can listen to that material on any MP3 player. But at any rate, many or most people are listening with earbuds or earphones. So there's something about the warmth of the human voice that's right next to your brain. It's getting in without a whole lot of filtering.
Yeah, I think that's really true. So yay for that.
Yes, and so we radio personalities and podcast personalities, I think we enjoy a special relationship to our listeners and perhaps become beloved, if we're fortunate, especially because of that kind of close proximity to the brain.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you and I could probably rattle off a short list of several in the Bay Area, like Michael Krasny, chief among them, who just really, have a great listening audience. And people, you know, it's something about the human voice, as you say, and asking interesting questions to interesting people. What could be more fun?
When I was a young boy and first got interested in ham radio, and I would have been 12, 13, 14, somewhere in that range, and before I got my license, I did have a shortwave radio, and I could listen to other hams. And so I would be in my little room at night with all the lights turned out and the glowing tubes of my radio. We had tubes back in those days.
Right.
And they were quite beautiful, some of them. And I would listen to, there were some hams in my area, who would just go on, and they were what is referred to in the hobby as rag chewers, that is, people who like to talk. And so there were certain favorite personalities that I just loved to listen to as a boy because they had a certain kind of charm and their rambling with their friends over the air.
How wonderful. Yeah. I'm realizing. Let's see, we've gotten off into a chat. I could start asking you questions about ham radio.
Yes, definitely.
And RSS feeds, but that may not be what people are most interested in hearing about this morning. I am. If you've just tuned in, you are listening to Dream Talk Radio. I'm Ann Hill, your host from 9 to 10 here on COWS, and I'm speaking with Dr. David Van Nuys, a professor emeritus at Sonoma State and podcaster extraordinaire at shrinkwrapradio.com. Oh, and also you have a Wise Counsel podcast mentalhealth.net.
Yeah, it's mental help. It can sound like mental health, but it's H-E-L-P, mentalhealth.net. And people can go to that one directly if they want to by going to wisecounselpodcast.com.
Oh, good, wisecounselpodcast.com. That's a little bit easier to say on the air.
Yes.
So tell me, you were a professor at Sonoma State for many years, then you retired, and now you're back teaching a class that sounds fascinating, and it's in the fall. Is it every year that you teach it?
Well, it was every year, even every semester for quite a few years before I retired. Mm-hmm. And I retired about 4 years ago, and then last year I was invited to come back and teach a section of that class last semester, so I did, and then I got invited to teach it again this fall, so I'm going to do that, and, you know, I have a number of guests come into that class, and I'm looking very forward to my guest, Ann Hill, who will be coming as a guest to our class.
Why, yes. Coincidentally, I believe in October, if I'm not mistaken.
I could look it up.
So the class is Myth, Dream, and Symbol. Now, is this a Jungian or a based class in myth and dream and symbol, or do you sort of go the gamut of the different approaches to the material?
I think it really is a Jungian-oriented class, as a matter of fact. Not that there aren't a lot of other approaches, and certainly I do touch upon some of those other approaches, but if you look at the readings, at the books that I assign, and I'd be happy to go over those with you,
sure.
I would say you would see that it's very Jungian in orientation. And this is, I have to give tribute to the person who hired me and who has passed on, but who was widely known in Sonoma County. I'm referring to Gordon Tappan. And he taught a class by this title way back when I was hired, which I started at Sonoma State, I think, in 1971. And he was very excited at that time. I remember when I first came out to interview for the job, and he put me up at his house, and we went for a walk. And he was talking with great excitement about dream groups, that he was putting students in small dream groups, and what a wonderful discovery process that was. And so here I am all these years later, putting students in small dream groups and finding it still to be a very exciting process.
Oh, well, it's so fascinating. Now, we've talked a lot about dream groups on this show, so regular listeners are probably have at least little hooks to hook different ideas about dream work on, but maybe you can share some of your approach to the dream groups that you set up in your Sonoma State class.
Sure, I'll be happy to. Well, I think both of us have been influenced considerably by Jeremy Taylor as well, who has really become an evangelist for this approach. Not the originator of it, but certainly has refined it and evangelized it, I think, more than anyone else that I'm aware of. And I actually met Jeremy at what might have been the very first ASD meeting, which was in Marin, the Association for the Study of Dreams. Do I have it right?
Yes, that's right.
Something like that.
And although now it's the International Association.
There, that's it, the IASD. And, you know, so basically we, the class meets for 15 weeks, and in the first 4 or 5 weeks, I do dream work in the large group. The class is limited generally to about 24 students, and so I want to model an approach to working with dreams and to kind of start off gradually and gently before I turn them loose in their dream groups. And so in the first class, I do an exercise that I call dream dramas, in which I break the students up into small groups, and they share, each person shares a dream going around their small group. And then they decide a dream to act out dramatically. And everybody in the group has to be involved in the dream drama, whether they're a character in the dream or an object or an inanimate force. Somehow they have to kind of personify that. And then the small groups come back and I dim the lights and they act these dreams out for the audience of the rest of the class. And often it's done in pantomime, because a lot of dreams don't really have a bunch of dialogue. And I kind of suggest to people that that may be the most powerful format to kind of preserve that mystery that seems to be inherent in the dream. I might have them reenact the dream more than once and move the dreamer through different roles in the dream. But the main thing that I'm trying to draw out, what I'll do after each dream drama is I'll ask the class to identify any feelings that seem to be there, any emotions that they experienced. I don't ask them to analyze the dream. Rather, I ask them, you know, what did you feel? And I'm trying to make the point early on there that I think that dreams are quite a bit about our emotions and have a lot of emotional content in them, and often are about conflicted areas in our lives. And of course, with my background and training in clinical psychology, sort of taking a therapeutic slant is the one that comes most naturally to me. So we start off in that way, and then in the next couple of classes for the experiential part, and I should say that the class is structured to be, there's a large cognitive component of, you know, of lecture or guest appearances and some films and et cetera, other kinds of media. And then each class, there is typically maybe about an hour. That's it's a three-hour and 40-minute class meeting once a week. And so at least an hour, if not more, is devoted to experiential work, that is to dream work. So in the next couple of classes, we'll use poetic techniques. I'll ask, I'll have somebody share a dream in the large group and then have everybody write a poem or a haiku. And we go around the group and everybody reads their poems. And the poems, as we hear them get read around the group, and of course people have all the usual resistances come up of, I can't write poetry. I'm not creative, et cetera. But we muddle on through that, and I kind of insist that they just give it a shot anyway. That it's not about poetic excellence. And so many of the poems end up honing in, and you hear the same themes coming up in these poems. That makes it clear that these people, in one way or another, have keyed into the central message of the dream. And so the point that I draw from this for the class is to say, you know, if I had asked you to analyze this dream, it would have taken you right into your head and you would have spun all kinds of elaborate theories and so on. But by asking you to write a poem, it puts you more in your metaphoric mind, which is more the place that the dream comes from. And you know, and you go right to the right place. So it's after a few sessions like that that then the class gets divided into permanent dream groups. And I have TAs that work with me. And so I used to rotate the TAs and myself around through the dream groups, but last semester, I experimented with having each of the TAs stay with their particular group. And I had a really good group of TAs, teaching assistants, that is. And I think because they stayed with that group, it helped to deepen the process. And so in those groups, we do the If This Were My Dream, which is this this group dream work technique that Jeremy Taylor and you and others of us have helped to evangelize. And the idea, and it sounds like your listeners would already be familiar with this, instead of doing what most people would be tempted to do initially, to say something like, oh, that dream means that you're really angry at your mother, you know, which may or may not be true, and puts the dreamer in
a... But who wants to hear that in class?
Yeah, and puts the dreamer in a very defensive posture.
Exactly.
You know, we insist that the person would need to say, if this were my dream, in my dream, I'm very angry at my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Which then leaves the dreamer free to kind of take it or leave it. If it hits home for them, if they get what Jeremy refers to as a tingle, that's great.
Yeah.
And if they don't, they just don't have to deal with it. But quite often they do get tingles.
Well, and I can imagine it's a wonderful way for, I mean, this is an undergraduate class, right?
So it is.
Probably the first experience of even talking about dreams many of your students have, and to be able to approach it in a really a non-threatening way and to have their first association with dream work be this sense that, oh, I get to trust my own intuition and my own feelings and my own response about my dream. I mean, what an amazing introduction to the whole field of dreams.
Well, it is, and it turns out to be kind of mind-blowing for many of them. They really discover that there is this kind of inner guidance, and they learn to listen to it. And for an academic, a quotes academic class, it's really quite remarkable the personal growth that we get to witness. And there are a couple of ways in which we get to see that. There are two assignments in particular that help to reveal this, because there are these two assignments that come due towards the end of the class. One is that everybody has to write a final paper that's an integrative paper about their dreams over the course of the semester. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of latitude in terms of how they structure it. It might be about a series of dreams or about a particular symbol that recurred or a theme that occurred in their dream life, but they're asked to look at the various tools that we've exposed them to over the course of the semester and their dreams and somehow write this integrative paper. And so the paper tends to be very revealing. You know, as often happens, there'll be students who are relatively quiet or who in the classroom setting in the larger class, it may not be apparent that they're getting anything out of the course. But when you read their paper, where they're sort of, it feels more private to them and safer, the things that they reveal are just mind-blowingly wonderful, and it makes it clear that there's so much that has gone on for them. And then the other way that this gets revealed is each student is required to do a creative project, ideally something with their hands, ideally something in a medium that they haven't worked with a lot. So if they're a painter, I kind of try to encourage them, well, try something other than painting that you're already so familiar with.
Right.
And then they present in the last few classes, they have a chance to present their creative project to the group, to the larger group. And we do something like If It Were My Dream, where their project is passed around and each person in the group gives the project a voice and says something.
Well, how wonderful.
I got so many of these ideas are pirated from my colleagues over the years, you know, kind of picked up and modified. and you know, give it a little bit of my own spin. But uh-huh. I don't know that I've, quotes, invented any of it.
Well, it sounds like you strung it together in a really nice way that probably makes people feel very welcome to explore their own dream content.
Well, that's certainly what I'm trying for.
I think it's particularly wonderful that Sonoma State has a class like that because you do have, I mean, the university, this is a state-sponsored university, although budget-wise, who knows how much sponsorship the state will actually give the state university.
Right.
But that's a whole other issue. But so a state-sponsored university that has a clinical psych path and also this depth psychology. So it's a really, I can imagine that having an introduction as an undergraduate to a real sort of a right brain approach to dreams, very emotion-based, very tactile and art-based approach to dreams would be a wonderful background, a wonderful sort of introduction to the material that people then go off into, you know, more of a clinical or a research-based career with, or they end up going more into the intuitive and do a sort of a depth, you know, the depth master's program. So really each branch I can see really benefiting from this type of introduction.
Yes, and, you know, I think it's very rare, as you point out, in a state-sponsored school. At this point in time, there might be some other schools where some course that is vaguely similar to this might be happening, but it would be very rare, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I feel very privileged. That's really what drew me to Sonoma State in the first place, was that I had heard that there was this relatively new, young department that was pretty much wide open, where you could teach what you wanted to teach in the way that you wanted to teach it. And so I'm really blessed to have spent my whole career there.
Very fortunate. And there's some wonderful faculty there. I happen to be friends with a few psych professors over at Sonoma State. And
yes.
Really, what a rich, what a wealth of knowledge and experience for students to draw on there.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit, I should probably back up and tell people who are just tuning in, you are listening to Dream Talk Radio on COWS, K-O-W-S-F-M here in Occidental, and my name is Ann Hill. I'm your host every Thursday from 9 to 10, and today I have with me talking on the telephone Dr. David Van Nuys, who is a professor emeritus at Sonoma State. He teaches a class, actually it's coming up this fall semester, on myth, dream, and symbol over at Sonoma State. And he also has a couple wonderful podcast series, Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel podcasts, all about different topics in psychology and mental health field and so on. So it's really, again, great to have you here with us. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the readings you have for this class, because we talked a little earlier about it being basically Jungian based, and so I'm kind of wondering what sort of a introduction to the myth and symbol material you give to your students.
Great, I'm glad you asked about that, and let me just insert here too, because we did talk about these podcasts. And so people might be under the impression that they have to have an MP3 player. Let me hasten to add that you can listen to these interviews. I have 213 interviews with people like Ann Hill and Jeremy Taylor and other people on the Shrink Wrap Radio podcast, and about another 50 on the Wise Counsel podcast. And you can listen to them on your computer. There is a player
right
there for each show, so you don't have to have an MP3 player. Okay,
that's
books.
Right. If you go to shrinkwrapradio.com, you can just listen to your heart's content with lots of fascinating interviews.
That's right. And about 100 of those, I haven't actually counted, 100 or more, there are transcripts for. I have such a devoted audience, I'm pleased to say, that some people have stepped forward and on a voluntary basis have created written transcripts for many of the interviews. So that's another
wonderful.
Great resource that's available to people for free. Okay,
great.
The books. The first book that we read is Jeremy Taylor, who I've already mentioned a couple of times, and I'll bet you've had him on as a guest.
I haven't, actually. I'm embarrassed to say, but I will. I will be having his wife, Kathy Taylor, on very shortly. She's written a wonderful book about her own dreams, and dreams and artwork is really her focus.
So. Oh, I didn't know that.
I love Jeremy. Oh, yes, yes.
I should be inviting her.
You should be.
Yeah, I've had Jeremy come as a guest to the class many semesters, and I've lined him up for this coming semester as well. Well, he's written several books. But I continue to be taken, particularly for the purposes of this class, with what I think was his first book, Dreamwork, Techniques for Discovering the Creative Power in Dreams. It's put out by Paulus Press. It's available in paperback. And it's a wonderful introduction to the whole process of dreaming. I'm sure that you're familiar with this book. So that's what I start them off with. And he,
that's a great introduction.
Yeah, it really is, because he goes into some of the showing how dreams have been valuable in the creative process for various scientists and authors to kind of establish the validity of dreaming, if you will. And then he goes into, you know, he really puts forth the rationale and the approach of small dream sharing groups. And he also talks about, I think he's got a list of 25 things that appear in every dream, or sort of 25 different ways that you could look at every dream. For example, he says that every dream has an element of humor, and every dream has an element that's commenting on our health, and every dream has a spiritual dimension, and so on. I don't know if I go that far to say that every dream has every one of those, but it is a wonderful list to alert us to, kind of a like a pilot's checklist, you know. You can look at your dream and say, well, what about this? I wonder, can I see this in there?
Have you checked the humor in there?
Yes, right.
Have you checked for humor?
Yeah. So that's a great book to start off with. Then the second book is Boundaries of the Soul, The Practice of Jung's Psychology by June Singer, who is a Jungian analyst. That book is kind of old. I'm a little embarrassed, but this is what happens to professors, is they fall in love with things from long ago, and then they stick with them forever. So this book was originally written, I think, in 1972. It also is available in paperback. It was this book that really opened up Jungian psychology for me. This was my introduction to it, really, because I did my PhD work in psychology at the University of Michigan, which was a very psychoanalytically oriented school at that time. The clinical psychology program was. I don't know if it still is or not, but at the time it was one of the last bastions in academia of psychoanalytic thought. And I have to say, you know, from this point in time, I think there was considerable value there. I probably should have applied myself even harder and taken away even more value. I was pretty rebellious. I rebelled against that perspective. There were things certainly about the psychoanalytic approach that I was and continue to be very critical of, at least as it was expressing itself then. It was very authoritarian, it felt to me, you know, kind of paternalistic, and also so focused on the pathological. So, but part of the gift of it was it caused me to explore on my own many other perspectives. And so I was doing my own alternate reading as a graduate student. So anyway, but it wasn't until I came out to Sonoma State that I discovered this book. I had heard, you know, it was the 60s when I was in graduate school, so people were talking about Jung and finding relevance in Jung. And I had picked up somehow maybe the wrong books by Jung, because I found them impenetrable when I, you know, sort of tried to get into it and figure out what it was all about, until I discovered this book by June Singer. And it just made it so clear, each of the concepts that, you know, she went into each of the major archetypes and so on, the anima and the animus and the shadow, and she related it to a lot of what was going on in the culture at that time during the 60s and 70s, and it just made total sense, and I was hooked at that point.
Well, that's a great touchstone in that book. And, you know, it's funny thinking about our first introduction to those Jungian archetypes and how much they have filtered into common knowledge at this point. I mean, that was 1972. Here we are in 2009. I mean, my kids, I mean, and their friends, they're adolescents, and they're talking about the shadow, and they're talking about the anima and the animus, and I'm just looking at them thinking, you're not supposed to have language for this yet. You're supposed to go through, you know, the dark night of the soul as a late teen and early adult and try and find something. But here it is, it's like breakfast cereal. It's all over in popular culture. It's fascinating.
Yeah, sometimes people ask, you know, what happened to humanistic psychology, because you don't hear people talking about humanistic psychology so much anymore. And that's the banner under which our department flew for so long. Mm-hmm. And I think precisely the same thing has happened, that so much of the ideas which were radical at the time have filtered out into the culture, that there's almost a sort of ho-hum, you know, it's not identified with a movement. It's just taken for granted.
That's right. Really fascinating. Who could have predicted that it would become so easily understood and so popular in the mainstream culture?
Right. So I think those of us who have labored in this particular vineyard, should think of ourselves as having been successful to some degree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's book number two for your class on Myth, Dream, and Symbol. Do you have any other readings that you ask your students to partake of?
Yes. And by the way, I should mention that there's selected chapters in each of these books, because I assigned 5 books, and believe me, it was very hard to limit myself to 5, because as you know, the literature on dreaming alone is huge. And on Jungiana is even huger. And so it's really hard to figure out, well, you know, what are you going to assign people?
That's
another
right.
important book is by Robert Johnson. And he's written many books. People will recognize titles like, what is it, Him and Her.
Yes, He or She.
Yeah, that's it. He, She.
Yeah.
It felt wrong when I said Him and Her, so thank you. It's He and She. And, well, he wrote one called Inner Work, which is a beautiful book with kind of a 4-stage approach to working with one's dreams, and he lays it out very carefully, very methodically, with examples for each of the 4 stages. So this really helps students to deepen their work. Then we read Hero with 1,000 Faces by Joseph Campbell. And this is where the myth part
classic.
Comes in. I'm not real strong on myths. As a kid, I did not, unfortunately, I was an impoverished child, did not get exposed to the Greek myths at an age where they would have, you know, taken hold. And and so it's always been hard for me as an adult to really internalize them and to remember them with any detail. What I did grow up on are fairy tales. And I remember as a child, back in the Dick and Jane era, see Spot. Come Spot, run Spot, run. See Dick, see Jane. That's sort of when I grew up. But as I got a little further along, the public school books would have fairy tales. It'd always be in the back of the book. It's like you had to do the hard stuff. And then there was this like candy in the back of fairy tales.
That's
I would
right.
always skip to the back and read those.
You know, I think that's, this reminds me of something. I was asked to write a chapter for a textbook on technology and child raising years ago. And I thought about this because I was the only person that they were asking who did not have a PhD in something. In fact, I was basically raising children at that time. And so I thought back to my university experience and I thought, okay, the chapter that I want to write is the chapter at the back of the book that's not assigned reading, but is so interesting that people want to read it anyway.
Yeah, so right.
I think that's really true in textbooks at any age. The stuff in the back that you'd never get to because you go through the whole year and you only are two-thirds of the way through the book, but the stuff in the back is the really interesting stuff.
Yeah. So Joseph Campbell, as you know, and as many of your listeners will know, is just a towering figure, I think, who, mm-hmm. Who studied mythology and who detected a pattern in there that he characterized as the journey of the hero. And once you see the template that he lays out, it's a template that you can't forget once you've kind of internalized it.
Yes,
and you see it everywhere. You see it in novels and movies and more importantly, in one's own life, because it's a template that is kind of a map, if you will, of the arc of psycho-spiritual growth that we're all on. And so that's a wonderful, I have the students read the first part of the book that's divided into two parts. The second part is more looking at mythology in relation to the genesis and end of the cosmos, of the universe, whereas the first section and longer section is really more about, is more personal. Mm-hmm. So it's very challenging reading because he was a very erudite man, and it's important to have a dictionary close at hand when you're reading Joseph Campbell, because you'll encounter words that most of us had not heard before.
And then there's those fascinating public radio broadcasts with Bill Moyers interviewing Joseph Campbell towards the end of his life.
Yes, the TV series, and sometimes
the PBS. That's right.
Yeah, and sometimes I'll show parts of that. You know, it's how to say this in a way that doesn't sound bad. Students have short attention spans these days. Have you noticed that at all?
I've noticed that. It's come to my attention once or twice, but then I forgot because my attention span is shortening too.
So it's kind of hard to show them a full length, one of those episodes.
Yeah.
Because I'm not, I'm not able to use those as fully as I would like to. And also, one of the things that's been disappointing to me, and I understand it at the same time, is I've wanted to play in class some excerpts from the interviews that I've done, because I've interviewed all of these people who are just, spectacular leaders in the whole dream work area.
Right.
And their tolerance for listening in class to an audio interview is very low. I can get away with playing maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And how much of this is my own nervousness about wanting to keep them entertained, I'm not sure. But I get the sense that after anything longer than that, they begin to feel a bit put upon. Which is ironic because I get letters from all over the world. I get emails from people saying that they've listened to some of these interviews two and three times, that they love them so much and that it's so important to them. It's like being a parent, It's the prophet in his own land is not recognized.
No, let's not get started down that road.
So
let me just do a little station ID here for those of you who are just tuning in. You're listening to Dream Talk Radio. I'm your host, Ann Hill, this Thursday and every Thursday. If you want to find out more about my show and the people who I have coming on as interviews, you can go to annhill.org. That's Ann with an E, A-N-N-E-H-I-L-L.org. And with me on the phone today is Dr. David Van Nuys, who is the podcast meister at shrinkwrapradio.com, which is fascinating place to go if you have any interest in any sort of topic related to psychology and dreams in particular, shrinkwraparapradio.com, and also wisecounselpodcast.net.com. So we have been talking about your class at Sonoma State, which is coming up this fall in Myth, Dream, and Symbol, and we've been talking a little bit about the readings that you ask people to partake of as a way to just get a basic introduction to the field of working with dreams and what lies hidden in the myths and symbols, even of eons ago, that still pop up in our dreams.
And there's one more book. There's the fifth book.
Oh, yes, sure.
And that is Man and His Symbols by Jung et al.
Oh, yes.
And so I have them read the chapter by Jung and a couple of the other chapters. And I just felt that it's really important that they read at least something by Jung. And so this chapter that he wrote, it was towards the end of his life when his students and others were pressing him. Can't you write something about your approach that really intended for a lay audience? And so I think he was in his 90s.
He had that wonderful dream about, does he talk about the dream in Myths, Dream, and Symbols that led him to think that maybe writing this book was the thing to do?
You know, I blush to say it's been a while since I've read what I'm assigning the students. I don't think that's in there. I think that's in the other book, which I've often been tempted to assign instead, but haven't. Memories, Dreams, and Reflections?
Yes, okay.
Or is it Dreams, Memories, and Reflections?
Dream.
I can never remember the order.
Memories, Dreams, Reflections, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Jung's, basically his autobiography.
Yes, and that also, along with the June Singer book, I think that book is just a wonderful intro into the whole Jung literature.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, that gives, I mean, if people read half of the assigned readings, they'll have a really good touchstone into the realm of Jungian and archetypal psychology.
So definitely.
That's great.
Yes, definitely.
Do you find that you have dreams about the class? I know this is kind of an odd question to ask maybe, but what made me think about it is this dream I was just mentioning of Jung's, where, you know, his students had been saying, you need to write something for a lay audience, for a general interest audience about all of these amazing theories you've put forth. And so he had this dream. I don't remember the details of it, but it was basically he was speaking to this enormous auditorium, and it was just an auditorium of everybody from all sorts of walks of life. He was talking about his life's work, and they were all listening with rapt attention. And he woke up from this dream thinking, well, maybe now is the time. Maybe my ideas will have a better reception. And so that's what led him to write, along with many of his students,
Memories, Dreams, Reflections, or Man and His...
No, the Man and His Symbols. Man
yes.
and His Symbols. That's what led him to write Man and His Symbols. So I'm wondering, and I found that to be true, too, when I'm thinking about a project and about to embark on a project, I will have, and maybe I'm wondering whether this is something that I really want to focus on right now, or whether it's something that's, you know, to be done much later down the pike. But I will listen to my dreams, and sometimes I'll have dreams that say, yes, this is exactly what you need to be doing. And other times they'll sort of point the arrow to another thing that I need to take up at that moment. So I'm wondering for you, I mean, you've been doing all this fascinating work. In your class, do you find you have those same sort of guidance dreams leading up to a new semester?
No, not quite, unfortunately. And, you know, your question prompts something else that I didn't mention, which is the students are all keeping a dream journal, and we haven't talked about that. And I've kept a dream journal as well, off and on over, you know, all these years of about 35 years. And what has happened for me at the end of the summer is often that I'll have a teaching anxiety dream, more so in the past than recently. But one of the things that I have been plagued by is are these teaching anxiety dreams, which follow the format of I'm in front of a class, and maybe I have nothing to say, or I'm lost my notes. The class is bored, restless. They're talking. Some people are getting up and leaving, and I'm just flooded with anxiety during that kind of dream.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wake up from that dream, there's such a tremendous sense of relief to discover that it's a dream. Well, I'm happy to say I've made progress in that area. Yeah, I have progressed. And I think one of the things that helped me progress was I shared this dream with one of my classes, and we decided to act it out. So the students got to throw spit wads at me and talk to each other and to do the whole traumatic thing.
How wonderful.
And I do think that experience helped me to get over it. Also, I think I've gotten better at becoming somewhat lucid when this sort of dream starts, and I can recognize even within the dream that this is that, and I don't need to go there. And so that's been good. And hopefully I've carried this kind of irrational fear of teaching. It's a kind of performance anxiety, and performance anxiety dreams are pretty common and widespread. And, and it's ironic that I've been a public speaker and a teacher all these years, and yet there's still this sort of underlying anxiety and concern about, do I really know anything, et cetera. And the irony is that when I walk into the classroom, I feel fully masterful. So it's funny that I get the flip side of it played to me sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, isn't that just, we could call that the shadow of public speaking or performance, that incredible anxiety. So in a certain way, I can imagine, if this were my dream is allowing me to vent all of my anxiety and really see my worst case scenario of what might happen when I get up in front of all those people, so that I live it fully. And then when I actually step in front of them, I can bring all my energy to it. It seems like there's sort of a yin-yang kind of a thing going on there.
I like that. Yeah, I like that.
let's vote for that interpretation.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I'm going to hold that interpretation. Yeah, it may be kind of like a pressure valve, like a steam valve, letting out some of the inevitable pressure, the charge of being in that sort of a situation.
And it is interesting to me. I think, not to be overly glib about anxiety dreams, but it does seem to me that they offer such a great opportunity to not only really understand where our nervousness comes from and, what might be upsetting us during the day that's, maybe it's sort of subterranean. We can't really put our finger on it, but we have this anxiety we're living with. Number one, the anxiety dreams just sort of lay it all out. And number two, that especially if they're recurring dreams, it's really an invitation to what you were talking about, lucidity. I can become aware enough in my dream to think, oh, right, here I am in front of that lecture hall again. I actually don't need to be this nervous because I've done this, 28 million times before. So we are able to actually shift our dreams when we have them long enough. So even though anxiety dreams are horrible when they come, and we just have to live through all those horrible feelings, that still there's the opportunity for moving them forward, for engaging in a different way with the same material.
Yes. As you were talking, I sort of had a flashback to childhood. Part of the origin of this, I think, for me, I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's house. She was a fundamentalist evangelist. And she would have a little Sunday school in her house, and she would call upon me, David, stand up and tell everybody how much you love the Lord.
Oh, Lord.
And so regardless of how much I was loving the Lord.
At that moment,
and at that tender age, you know, I was forced to kind of stand up and testify. So that kind of comes up for me as I'm thinking about this right now. And as I think about that experience, there was both a positive and a negative aspect. The negative aspect clearly being the call to testify something that I wasn't necessarily feeling, being called upon to, in a sense, utter a public lie, to put it in its baldest form. And then the positive side of it was it gave me a lot of early practice in public speaking and probably helped to set the course, you know, for my life in that way of being somebody who would tend to put himself or get thrust into that role. There you have it, folks. The psychoanalysis of David Van Nuys in the last few minutes of the class, of the show.
Well, you know, it really reminds me of one of my favorite quotes of Jeremy Taylor's, which is that he says, improvisation is the only skill worth cultivating. And I think there's a great truth in that. What your experience of with your grandmother reminds me is how often we're thrust into the position of having to basically improvise, you know, lie or testify in some way, or talk about our experience in a way that we're completely unprepared to do. So we really have to make it up as we go along.
Yes.
But at the other end of the spectrum, once we've reached adulthood and achieved a certain mastery at various things in our little toolkit or skill set, you know, improvisation then becomes the act of letting go of all of the details of every textbook that we've read and just trusting that we have the skill and we have the resources that we need, and so that we can just improvise, draw on all of that information and experience we've had, and improvise. And I think that's, you know, what I like about his quote, is that improvisation is the only skill worth cultivating means that first you have to actually gain experience and knowledge and wisdom, if you will, about certain things, so that then you can rest on that, trust that that's there, and then you can go into this whole realm of improvisation, which really, I mean, that's what public speaking is. I mean, even, but I'm sure you've had this experience too. I'll go into a crowd and I'll have notes or a little outline, but it's really all improvisation. I'm trusting that the line I've written on the page is something that I can look at and then, you know, have about 15 minutes of things to say about it. So it's really, it's actually fun when you can get to the point of trusting what you know, or for me, that's when it gets fun, is when I can actually trust what I know.
Yes, that's really well said. And one of the things that I've discovered that's closely related to that is often it's best the first time. Like when it comes out, improvise the first time in a class or presentation, and then later when I, I'm doing something related to that again, I'll try to pull up that same thing again and reuse it. But there was something about that first, the energy of the first time when it was really fresh and improvised, that makes it better that first time.
Isn't that funny? It's very true. It's that first take is often the best. Well, we have been talking with Dr. David Van Nuys here on Dream Talk Radio this morning, and thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk about your work at Sonoma State with your Myth, Dream, and Symbol class, and also your podcasts. I hope listeners will go to shrinkwrapradio.com or wisecounselpodcast.com and check out some of your interviews. I mean, there's an incredible breadth of knowledge about various different topics that I'm sure will interest listeners of this show. And so thank you so much for coming on the air with me today.
Well, it's really been a delight, Anne.
Great. Well, you know, this interview will be up on my website, annhill.org, although I'm sort of at the, close to the beginning of the learning curve you were describing at the beginning of the show today. I have all of these podcasts, and now I have to figure out, you know, the little formatting and all of the technical glitches, but they will get up there, so you will be able to listen to this entire interview, those of you who are just tuning in here on COWS. So it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I wish you well, and we will be in touch.
Wonderful. I look forward to it.